You're listening to The Stressless Life with Dr. Yip, the podcast about conquering your fears and overcoming anxiety. Our question for the day is, what is it like to live with panic disorder? I'm your host, Noah Larrison. Let's say hello to Dr. Yip.
Hi, Noah.
Dr. Yip is a licensed psychologist who's board certified in behavioral and cognitive therapy and an expert in the treatment of anxiety and OCD. So last episode, we talked about panic attacks and panic disorder, but this time we wanted to get more in depth into panic disorder and to really get into what patients who suffer from this actually go through on a daily basis.
Yes. You know, I think a lot of people, they don't understand how severe panic disorder can become, especially when we avoid. That is why avoidance is the biggest no-no for anyone experiencing anxiety and especially panic attacks.
So when you talk about avoidance, what type of things are they avoiding?
Life, to the point where there is no more life. And when I say there's no more life, what I mean is they don't do anything. They can't do anything, not because they don't want to, because they can no longer. So for example, let's say you're afraid of feeling dizzy, because feeling dizzy would mean that you'll feel nauseous, and if you're nauseous, you might vomit. And vomiting is the worst thing because, well, you know, vomiting sucks, right? For anyone who's vomited before. And also maybe the embarrassment of vomiting. So therefore, this person would avoid any situations that could potentially trigger the sensation of dizziness. Can you imagine how many different situations can actually trigger dizziness in a given day?
I would imagine they probably wouldn't want to go too high off the ground, or maybe want to go in a car or too fast.
Wouldn't go to the playground, wouldn't go to the gym, wouldn't make quick movements, wouldn't make sudden movements, sudden turning movements, wouldn't want to see things that are moving in circles because that could create a little bit of dizziness. And when I say dizzy, I know when I say this, some people might think, okay, well, that's a little extreme. You have to keep in mind, though, that the fear of feeling dizzy, feeling nauseous, would be so intense that even the smallest suggestion of this might trigger dizziness is feared upon. It's kind of like that saber tooth is right in front of you. So even if you watch a merry-go-round, that could get you dizzy, and the person would avoid it at all costs. And it doesn't just have to be about dizziness. It could be about any of the physical sensations that we discussed at our last podcast. For example, your pounding heart, feeling like your heart is going to jump out of your chest, feeling like you can't breathe, you're choking, feeling hot or cold, and feeling like you're losing control over yourself, feeling like you're going crazy. Any of these physical sensations that you find uncomfortable, you would avoid it, even the smallest hint of it, at all costs.
So the reason you're avoiding it, is it because the dizziness is so uncomfortable or the heart palpitations are so uncomfortable? Or is it that it's your appraisal, your head's belief about those physical sensations is that they're so bad? And that's why you avoid them.
The experience itself probably is inducing discomfort, right? Because, I mean, being dizzy is uncomfortable. The person with panic disorder, though, appraise it to an extreme. For example, if I was to use a scale of 0 to 10, 10 being the most uncomfortable experience that you can ever go through, and 0 being you have absolutely no physical sensation at all, people who experience panic disorder and panic attacks are inclined to appraise their physical discomfort as 7, 8, 9, 10s. Whereas the rest of us might experience them as, oh yeah, it's a 2, 3, 4 even. So these people are highly sensitive to their bodily sensations. They're highly attentive and in tune to their internal physiological experiences.
Now, is this only negative body sensations? Like, for instance, are they more ticklish or something?
You know, if ticklish is on their list, that could be it.
Okay, fair enough. In terms of avoiding then, what are some of the consequences that happen?
Well, you begin to build yourself a prison of what feels safe and what doesn't feel safe. And whatever doesn't feel safe is pushed away at all costs, even if that means at the cost of your living a functional, satisfying life. So I've had patients who aren't able to go to school, who's had to quit their jobs, who's had to limit their physical activity. I've worked with the guy who couldn't even walk up a flight of stairs because walking up that flight of stairs triggered panic attacks because his heart would be palpitating after a flight of stairs. I've had patients who aren't able to enjoy life and activities that they would ordinarily enjoy in the past. I had a guy who used to play baseball, and he experienced his heart palpitating during a game once and had a panic attack where he pretty much had to be on the ground and kind of catch his breath, and he was really, really dizzy and almost even vomited. And that was embarrassing for him. And from that point on, he stopped playing baseball. I've had even kids. You know, panic disorder isn't as common in younger children. We have had a child, I think she was probably 7 at the time, and she had panic disorder. So any physical sensations in her body that she deemed as dangerous would trigger this panic attack. And it got to the point where she was constantly throwing temper tantrums. Parents did not know what was happening. She refused to go to school. She refused to play with her friends. She stopped all after school activities. She couldn't do sleepovers anymore, couldn't do camp anymore. And she was basically homebound. And guess who had to be homebound with her?
Her parents.
Absolutely. So unfortunately, for children and even adults who live with others, so a spouse, significant other, many times the family members are entrenched and involved into the person's avoidance behavior. So whatever the person can no longer do, family members often pick up the slack.
From the patient's perspective, if I know that if I walk up the stairs, I'm going to become incredibly dizzy and get heart palpitations, I'm not going to go up the stairs. Why would I?
You're right. Why would you? Well, the problem with not going up the stairs is that you avoid it. And in avoiding it, what you're basically doing is reinforcing the belief, the false belief that this stair is dangerous and I can't walk up the stairs because if I do, my heart will be beating too fast and it's going to be uncomfortable. And who knows, I might have a heart attack as soon as I get to the top of the stairs. Though that belief is not accurate. That belief is a catastrophic perception into what's really happening. What's really happening is you are using endurance. You're using your body's muscles to get up that flight of stairs. And just like any exercise that we engage in, yes, your heart is going to be beating, and your heart is beating is because, like what we said, your heart is your body's motor. And when your body is using excess energy, that motor is going to run faster. And therefore, you're feeling your heart beating. Just because that's what's happening, it doesn't mean it's bad. It doesn't mean that your heart is going to explode, or even though it might feel like it's pounding really hard, it's not really going to jump out of your chest. Except people with panic disorder, that's what they believe, that it actually might happen.
What would going up the stairs and inducing the panic attack, how is that going to help things, change things?
First of all, what we help patients to do is label the experience correctly. So when you're going up the stairs, what you're doing is you're using the muscles and you're asking your heart to work for you. And if you're asking your heart to work for you, that's exactly what it's going to do. And you're going to feel that. So as you get to the top of the stairs, yes, your heart will be beating faster because it's working harder. And that's exactly what it is that you're experiencing. You're experiencing your heart doing the work. And if you shift your focus, you shift your thinking to that direction and perceiving your heart as something that's functioning and doing work for you rather than it's out of control and it's just beating out of control and it's going to explode, then you're already appraising the situation accurately, right? So earlier you asked me, are these people misappraising the situation? Well, one way to correct that is to label the experience for what it is rather than what our minds catastrophize it to be. So that's the first thing. Now, once you get to the top of the stairs, what also happens cognitively is that you understand, oh, I made it up the stairs. Yes, this feels uncomfortable. This doesn't feel right, though I did it. And wow, nothing bad happened to my heart. And yes, it's beating really fast right now, though over time, the beating starts to calm back down without doing anything at all. The heart calms back down again because that's what the heart does. It's doing exactly as what it's made to do.
It sounds like you're saying that the avoidance of going up the stairs or the avoidant behavior is actually worse than the panic attack.
Absolutely, because the panic attack occurs based on your appraisal of the situation, right? You're appraising the situation as dangerous, and therefore you're sending signals to your brain to trigger your fight or flight alarm. And that's what's happening. That's what a panic attack is. It's basically just your fight or flight alarm at excess. And your avoidance, it's almost like it's doubly worse. I don't even know if that's the word or if that's a true word. It's worse when you avoid because not only are you reinforcing that this is dangerous, you're not giving yourself the opportunity to realize this actually isn't dangerous. And that's what happened to so many of the patients that I've worked with, is that they become housebound because anything that is outside of the house that might trigger a panic attack is avoided. Not only do they avoid things that are dangerous, they have safety behaviors. So I know last episode we were talking about benzos. For many of the patients that I've worked with, they want to make sure that they've got their benzos on them. So if they have a random panic attack, they can just pop a pill and their fight or flight trigger would slow down. They avoid all people, situations that would potentially trigger the panic attack. And they need to feel assured that they're going to be okay. So one of the things that family members and friends often complain of is that they're constantly asking, they're constantly calling, checking in, getting reassurance to see if they're coming back home, to see when they're coming back home, to see if they're okay. So these are tactics, safety tactics that a lot of people suffering from panic disorder engage in to make sure that they are going to be okay. And the reality is there isn't any evidence that suggests that they're not going to be okay other than the physical panic attacks.
If some listener out there is maybe has a relative or a spouse or a child that has panic disorder, what should they do?
Well, the first thing is you want to be honest. When you reassure someone, what you're basically doing is you're placating them. You're placating them by telling them everything is going to be fine. The reality is, how in the world do you know? Do you know that an earthquake isn't going to happen?
No.
Do you know whether I'm going to be okay?
No.
No, right? That's the reality. So respond to your loved one with reality. So if you have a child who's constantly asking, am I going to be okay? The reality is, well, honey, you appear okay to me right now. And that's the truth. I don't see anything that is wrong right now. You never want to forecast the future. And you never want to give the person dishonest information just to make them feel better. Because the reality is, the person that you are reassuring already knows what is reality and what's excessive. And they want to hear it from other people. Just because they hear it, it doesn't mean that their fears go away. Because I can tell you, I've worked with so many family members and loved ones where they will tell you it gets annoying. Because the questioning and the reassurances never stops. It just keeps going. And they can ask you the same question in a thousand different ways, and you would give them the exact same answer. And even though it might feel okay in the moment, the next second, they're back to asking that question. So no matter how you respond to the person, it won't be enough. So you might as well just give them correct information. And I would highly encourage people suffering from panic attacks, and especially those that involve family members and loved ones, to seek professional help. You can find therapists on the ADAA.org website. ADAA is the Anxiety and Depression Association of America. It's the national nonprofit for anxiety and depression.
In closing here, let's try to talk about in general, how some of your patients have overcome panic disorder and returned to leading healthy lives.
Well, remember we talked about the components of cognitive behavior therapy, right? The behavioral component in CBT here is interoceptive exposures. And we talked a little bit about that last time, so I don't want to go into too much details. Basically, we produce situations that resembles the physical discomfort that the person fears and avoids. And we foster that sensation so that the person has the opportunity to engage in specific exercises that triggers these discomforts. And through time, they experience habituation, which is basically you feel the discomfort slowly going away. Okay, so that's the behavioral part. Then the cognitive part is that we teach you to label and identify the situation for what it is. We teach you what the difference is between the catastrophes that your mind constantly goes to and what's actually happening in the real world, so that you see the discrepancy and you learn more and more to appraise your environment and the perceived dangers realistically than through your faulty appraisals of danger.
It sounds like patients with panic disorder are avoiding a reality that doesn't really exist.
They are avoiding a catastrophe that doesn't really exist. And the point is to get them to see what is realistic, and that the probability of this catastrophe happening is very, very low.
Fair enough. Thank you for listening to the Stressless Life podcast. You can join the discussion and find more information at www.dryip.com/thestresslesslife. Please write to us with questions and comments at thestresslesslife@dryip.com. Until next time, stay stressless.